I'm Christopher Lydon with the breakthrough Open City novelist Teju Cole, who is pulling us into the stream of a very modern consciousness and showing us how to write about a refined global mind in motion. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Teju Cole practices, in fact, global conversations with a sort of adopted American attitude. He was born in the States of Nigerian parents, but he grew up in Nigeria, came back here at age 17, and has now burst on the scene of this winter-spring 2011 with the huge cheering for his first novel called Open City. It's a privilege to be meeting you, Teju Cole, especially here in Henry James's old precinct, Washington Square Park in New York City. Talk about the palimpsest of New York. Talk about the open city. This is it, right?
This is it right here. You know, you on a day like this, you feel more alive than on other days because your senses are awake. You see a flock of blackbirds that's just gone racing through these trees over here. And because you're more sensitive to the physical senses, your sense of sight, you see farther, you smell the leaves and you see the people and you can hear all kinds of noises in the park. For that reason, I think that maybe your psychic senses are also a little bit more awake. And as you said, you know, New York has a history, and we're looking at it in the built environment here. This is a very old park, you know. Henry James was here, and this was a battleground, and all of those things. So I think this is a great day for this conversation.
Keep looking. I love the way exactly your mind sort of takes every scene apart.
Maybe the process I was going through when I was writing this book was asking myself, what am I looking at here? You ever watch those detective shows and the old grizzled detective comes into the scene and he says, all right, what we got, you know, or what am I looking at here? It's like, give me the précis of the situation, but then we start to dig. And that was sort of the approach I took to writing this book. I wanted to give the seemingly descriptive or banal information that is visible about the place, but then use that as an entryway into what else is going on below the surface. In a place like this, for example, on this day, what we see is an apparently uncomplicated scene of urban leisure on a Thursday afternoon. But we know that all of that is happening within a historical context and within a social context. But I think that when you're looking at a scene like this one, which is so free and so happy and so relaxed, you also have to be aware of the fact that this is a very tense time in American public life.
How could you prove that with the naked eye today?
For example, you could say to yourself that New York City is an astonishingly diverse place. But when I look at a place like this, which is really one of the most diverse agglomerations, even within New York itself, this part of town is especially not segregated. And yet what we see around us are all kinds of evidence of segregation, for example, which you might not notice if you were not alert to it, you know. The young white students from NYU hang out with people of their own race. Very often when you see black women of a certain age, they are working as nannies for white babies. This is the American reality, though, to which we tend to put an overlay of innocence and say, well, everything is fine.
Teju, when you see New York revealing itself to my blind eyes, just sing right out. But let me just say, there are two open cities in this book, or maybe three if you count the title of the book. But one is in Brussels, which went neutral in World War II and survived physically in its medieval form. But then there's the other one here in New York City. Palimpsest, as we say, a multinational, multi-temporal sort of living ruin. So what we know about open cities is that they survive. Openness is a key to survival. But what makes an open city so interesting, and what makes it thrive?
I think it's the doubleness of that, what you would call the double consciousness of openness. Open city in the military sense of allowing the invader to come in, whatever that invader might be, and to live with it for the sake of survival. But also because in our language, open is positive. In the English language, to say something is open, open-minded, open source, you know, open-hearted. And I think many people, when they think of New York as an open city, they think it literally is open. It takes all comers. As they say of another open city that I am familiar with, the city of Lagos, Nigeria, they say, Eko Baole Ogbole, which means Lagos is open to the thief and it's open to the lazy person. Everybody's welcome. And I think New York is that way too. It's open to people who want to come here and work, and it's open to people who don't want to work, and it's open to people who have bad luck, and it's open to people who have good luck. People of all races and, you know, sexual orientation and levels of wealth and life histories and levels of innocence. And that's what's interesting to me about it, that this is a place that thrives on perpetual renewal. There's always something being built. There's always a city. There's always a building going up in the city. And at the same time, it's a place that is absolutely saturated with ominous energies that come from what deals the city has struck, what decisions it has made at different points in its history, and crucially, I think, the specific forms of oppression that have led to the marvelous infrastructure that we see around us.
Teacher Cole, your book, Open City, just overflows with these observations. You write, each neighborhood of the city appeared to be made of a different substance. Each seemed to have a different air pressure, a different psychic weight. But then you write specifically about the site of the Twin Towers. You write, the site was a palimpsest, as was all the city, written, erased, rewritten. There had been communities here before Columbus ever set sail, before Verrazano anchored his ships in the Narrows, or the black Portuguese slave trader Esteban Gomez sailed up the Hudson. Human beings had lived here, built homes, and quarreled with their neighbors long before the Dutch ever saw a business opportunity in the rich furs and timber of the island and its calm bays. Generations rushed through the eye of the needle, and I, one of the still legible crowd, entered the subway. I wanted to find the line that connected me to my own part in these stories. So it's open historically in a strange way.
That's right. You know, one thing I experienced in the writing of this book was almost the impossibility of telling a story, especially a story set in a city, because what you're tempted to do is to give an account of everything that you're experiencing. Who put that building up, and who planted that tree? If you take all of us together, we're almost like a latter-day race that is living on the built environment made by another race that came before us, just because their values and their way of being in the world is different from ours. So that that was an interesting challenge for me, to give an account of the city that confronted this essential mystery, that this city, like many others, is a space that has been pre-inhabited, that contains the stories of people who are gone, who are vanished. And we look at their inscriptions, and we engage with their monuments, and we walk along their paths. Every time you walk down Broadway, you're walking along an ancient cattle path that was put down by Native Americans, who then had an appalling encounter with European invaders and were more or less wiped out. But we still walk down their roads. And those roads themselves and many of those buildings were built by slave labor in this city, by people whose not only whose lives have been erased from the record, but whose deaths, in a way, have been erased from the record, because only recently was the burial ground of the slaves rediscovered. And even then, most of that burial ground is covered with office buildings now. You know, so there's this essential mystery of life in this city, that it contains others who are not us in the present time, because I'm not you and you're not me, and maybe we don't live in the same neighborhood, but it also contains others who are not us in the sense that so much of it was made by those others.
Did you call it so fascinating to hear you talk so much the way you write, spinning, free associating, riffing off what you see and what an extraordinarily well-educated mind is thinking? That, I must say, was the central part of the fascination of the book, to sort of get in to your mind, but also into my own. I think that's the way I talk to myself all the time. You haven't mentioned music yet, really, but music is such a big part of this book and of your own head, complaining about public radio disc jockeys or explaining why you listen to online music, and then especially talking about Gustav Mahler in Life and Death. Bring the music piece into sort of this process of Teju Cole's head.
Sure thing. I mean, music is very important to me. As something to listen to, as a way of getting into other worlds. But also, for me as a creative person, structurally, I'm always fascinated by what musicians are doing. One major peculiarity of this book, which is told in the first person, so if you read any section of the book, it's almost as if I, the author, I'm talking about something I experienced or something that's in my life. But the interesting thing about writing this book is I am a big fan of Mahler, as Julius is, but I'm just as big a fan of jazz, which he has no feeling for at all. So, you know, sometimes when I'm talking to people about Julius, I'm usually more worried that they will assume from reading the book that, oh, well, but this guy doesn't like jazz.
You have other characters do the jazz pieces.
That's right. I'm not, you know, there are certain ideas that Julius has that I don't embrace, and there are certain things that he does, certainly, that are not laudable things. I'm much less worried about that. I don't care if people think I'm, you know, I decapitate people in my spare time. But as long as they know that I love jazz, we're fine. But Mahler is important, and discovering the story of Mahler and how intimately connected it was to New York, for me, became an interesting way to weave music into what is essentially a story of mourning. Open City is a story of mourning for the mood that this city carried with itself after 9/11. It's told through the experience of one character who finds himself in a deeply sorrowful world. And he does not focus exclusively on 9/11. And in fact, he talks very little about 9/11. But that is the event that governs his digressions into the past and into the troubled present. And Mahler's role in that is as an elegist who lived here exactly 100 years ago. And then he left New York in 1911 and then died that year after writing his Ninth Symphony, which Julius goes to see a performance of at the end of the book. So I just wanted to weave those things in, because Mahler as an elegist is actually an important strain of American culture in ways that we are not always aware of.
You answer an important question that I had about those sections, because among Mahler's very late works were the famous Das Lied von der Erde, and then followed by his Ninth Symphony and the start of a tenth. But as you said, he kept saying goodbye. And in fact, there's a line here I love. He was the genius of prolonged farewells.
That's right.
And I kept wondering, what were you driving at in this book? What was he saying goodbye to? What is Julius saying goodbye to? What are we saying goodbye to? And why does that resonate so at the center of your idea?
You know, I'm very glad that you... you pick up on that aspect of what I wrote about Mahler, because this is part of why he was important to me as a symbol. It's not just enough to do the thing and say goodbye to it, because the goodbye is its own thing, and it can be a very elaborate thing. I feel that after 9/11, we definitely entered a new stage, a new phase in the life of this civilization, whatever this civilization is. But I think it was also clear to us that it was the end of something. And I think many people feel that we're at the end of something. We're living through a farewell to so many things at this moment, you know? That something is ending. And it's hard to get a grasp on it.
But
so
here's the paradox with Mahler. You write about his last works. The overwhelming impression they give is of light. The light of a passionate hunger for life. The light of a sorrowful mind contemplating death's implacable approach. Light and dark.
Light
extreme.
And dark. Very, very important. The example I give elsewhere in the book is of being in the middle of the city on a day like this, on a sunny day, especially as the sun starts to go down. Part of the street is shadowed and part of it is in light. But the part that is in shadow is in parts illuminated by reflected light from the towers, from the buildings, from the glass. And the part that is illuminated is partly in shadow because of the racing clouds. So light is shot through with dark, and dark is shot through with light. And, you know, my hope is that people don't read this book and just feel this is the most depressing thing ever.
Oh, no.
You know,
no.
But that they feel that this is something that deals with very serious themes, but that it is illuminated. I almost call the book, some of it is illuminated. Not everything. Some of it.
Go back to Julius for a minute. He's closing some doors and opening others. He's a psychiatric resident in a hospital. He's about to go into sort of public practice, and he does, in fact. But I'm just intrigued by what's ending and what's beginning for him.
You know, in one of the... and you're a very good reader. You're a very close reader, and I really appreciate that. There's a passage in the book that evokes just what you were talking about. It's one of the very few places in the book. There are a few incidences, but this is one of the most pointed situations where somebody criticizes Julius directly. His old professor, whom he loves, says, Julius, you've got to be careful about closing too many doors. Says that directly to him, you know, and it just sort of passes. And even the way that Julius records it, you think that it didn't get in. It didn't penetrate into his consciousness. But I wanted to have Professor Saito say that to him. Because this is a man who is like we are. He has his blind spots. He is porous to the world, you know. He takes it all in, and he has a very compassionate eye.
Yes.
That allows him to see things that many other people might not even see in the world around, and to see the suffering of others. But he also has a practiced form of avoidance.
Yes.
And aversion for things that maybe he chooses or maybe he doesn't. But like many of us do, he ignores certain things just as a way of making his life simpler. And so he could easily sit down with someone and talk to them for hours and sort of absorb their stories. Or he could talk to someone for 5 minutes and find a way to jump out of the situation, to escape.
Right. And if he doesn't like their poetry, he's not going to meet them again.
If he doesn't like their poetry, he'll never go back there again.
Let's talk about Julius. He has come to this country and got a good education from Africa, which is a big leap to begin. He's free, he's successful, he's thoughtful, he's reasonably happy, I think. And at the same time, he's very detached.
Yeah.
He's alienated from his mother, he can't find his grandmother, his girlfriend has gone to the West Coast. you hit on his great quality. He asks people to tell them his stories. There's something about his presence that opens people up. And yet, he cuts no slack, for example, for his fellow Africans driving cabs or whatnot, mm-hmm. or for refugees, mm-hmm. or for poor victims of the hardships of the world. Mm-hmm. He is a great listener, but he's not a great lover of anybody or anything.
I'm not sure that is true. I think he's a great lover of many things and of many people, but he is not total in his love. He's not a world spirit. He's not the Dalai Lama, and he is not ourselves as we like to present ourselves to ourselves. Maybe he's just a little bit more honest about it than many of us are, which is that he says, these are the limits of my love. These are the limits of my ability to be part of the group. I've heard from many people that, oh, well, he's cold and he's detached. As if this were the first character in the history of literature to be at the same time intelligent as at a remove from humanity. Hmm. Hamlet, as different as he is from Julius, was, and they do have a lot in common, by the way. You know, the father's dead, can't get along with the mother, you know, spent a lot of time inside his own head, just broke up with his girlfriend. Yeah. You know what I mean?
So, but what would Julius kill or die for?
Well, that's a difference. But that's also the similarity, because it takes Hamlet a long time to commit to killing or dying for anything also. And we have a conclusion with him. With Julius, we don't necessarily have this leap into that kind of decision-making. But we've got Hamlet, we've got Stephen Hero in Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, we've got Camus Meursault, we have Coetzee's David Lurie. So the cold and detached and rather intellectual character is nothing new at all. What would be impossible to write would be a character whose lassitude was so extreme that it extended to having no interest whatsoever in the world. Then that's not an interesting book. But to have a guy who is actually interested in the world, who is connected to infinity in some way, and at the same time has a hard time with human relationships, I think that's where the interest can be. That's what the possibility of interest is.
What is Julius's secret when he goes to Brussels, for example, and falls into a long series of conversations with a Moroccan Muslim named Farouk? He has a wonderful way of sort of telling people, give me your best shot. I want to know what you're thinking. And they do. What's that trick? I want to learn that as an interviewer.
Yes. You know what I think about that is that it's actually not a trick at all. You know, I think you find that people want to tell you their stories.
True.
You know, we're meeting in person for the first time, you and I, and I'm sort of willing to sort of dig in there and give you my best shot about these things that we're talking about. It might not necessarily be what did I have for breakfast this morning or who was my girlfriend when I was in college, but it's even deeper than that. It's asking me about my thoughts about life and about literature and about the work that I have devoted my life to. I think people are willing to talk if you can give them a sense that you're willing to listen. Mm. You know? So I actually find this a mode of realism. I was concerned with realism in this book, and it's realistic to believe that when you sit next to someone on the plane,
yeah,
depending on your attitude and your openness, they will tell you something that they would never tell their sibling.
Fascinating.
I actually encounter it over and over again. Most of the stories in Open City are invented, but they sort of come out of the model of my own tendency to talk to strangers. It seems to me that every time I get into a cab, the cab driver sort of downloads to me who they are and what they're up to. I mean, right away. I mean, if they say one or two things and you respond in the right way, that's sort of the skeleton key. They will, the next thing you know, they're telling you all about their mistresses. That's a common one.
Another piece, though, about Julius. In this book, we only really get Julius's view of Julius until the very end.
That's right.
When a woman who had known him in Africa accuses him of essentially of raping her 18 years earlier. And he's outwardly knocked for a loop. He can't remember it, doesn't know what she's talking about. But she stands her ground and yells at him. Things don't go away just because you choose to forget them. But for Julius, in a way, they do. What's that about?
Well, for Julius, things go away because he chooses to forget them. Because for us all, things go away because we choose to forget them. But further, we choose to forget the fact that we choose to forget things. It's all about maintaining our innocence about the past. Certainly for societies, things go away because we choose to forget them. Which is why we don't wake up every morning in this city and think about the Native American past. Which by rights we really should. It's because for the people who were erased from here, you know, for their spirits to regard us, it's almost as if, you know that small Polish town named Auschwitz?
Yeah.
Just a regular old little village. You know, they've got nothing to do with a camp. But there's a heavy historical memory that's there. It's a different kind of memory simply because this is one that is memorialized and retained by the world. So, as with the macrocosm, same thing with the microcosm. As go societies, so go human beings, so goes the human psyche. There is much that is remembered and memorialized and celebrated, and then there is much that is tactically forgotten, erased, until somebody who is concerned raises the issue. You know, I came to the U.S. only about 20 years ago, and so my experience as an African American is limited to that time period, my own personal experience of it. But one thing I often think about is, why was it so hard? If by the middle of the 19th century, slavery was outlawed and the war ended and black people were free, why 100 years later did the same people have to take to the streets in such great numbers to struggle so arduously for basic rights, for basic rights that pertain to human dignity? Why is it so difficult for people who have done wrong to admit their wrongdoing and make it right? I think about that a lot. And that's only an example. I'm not obsessed with that one example, because I think the same thing goes for the rights of gay people and for the rights of women. Why is it that only within the last 3 years did we see a law that guaranteed equal pay for women? What's the matter with us? What is this inertia that is at the heart of oppressive relationships? Even when you realize that it's wrong, inertia allows it to just go on. And I think that that's what happens in the lives of people also. You could be a good person. You could think of yourself as a good person, as a hero in the story of your own life. But you still have these dramatic areas of elision and of erasure that you willingly or inadvertently participate in?
I'm so glad I asked that question, because I now realize that there's a lot buried in those few pages, and that Judas is very convincing that he's Buffalo. He can't imagine what she's talking about, and yet there's something there.
And yet we also know that he's a man of great imagination, so why should it be beyond him?
Yeah.
You know, someone suggested to me recently, I had a lovely opportunity to present this book in a classroom, and I asked the students what they thought the open city was. What is this? What's going on? And one of them said that she thought that the open city was Julius.
Hmm.
And I thought, yes, that is as good a reading as any. That it is within himself that something ominous and unsolved is going on.
Hmm.
As much within himself as within the city.
How is it that when Julius goes to that other open city, Brussels, 60 years after the war, he finds a very closed city? It's uptight and scared about Muslims.
Yes.
And in general, sort of frozen. Yet he also finds there, running the internet cafe, this extremely voluble, incredibly well-educated, a theorist and a wannabe activist in politics,
yes,
Farouk, who is sort of an open city in himself.
That's right. Well, Farouk is a double for Julius.
I love the way you present him. May I say, you say he had the passion of youth, but his clarity was unfussy and seemed to belong to someone who had undertaken long journeys.
That's right, yes. You know, and later on in the book, the poet at the post office says to Julius, "I recognize you. You look like somebody who has undertaken long journeys." Milan Kundera talks about how, as an author, you embed so much in your book that no one else will ever discover. So reading that from him was kind of comforting for me, to know that all the little doublings and all the little games I play will not ever be completely unveiled. But that's fine. But I think it was obvious to some readers of the book, for example, to James Wood, that Farouk and Julius were doubles of each other. And I wanted Brussels to be a double of New York, but I wanted to do an eccentric double. I think London would have been too obvious, and Paris would have been something else. I wanted Brussels because it was out of the way, and it had some of the same problems, and it had different problems. I wanted Farouk in Brussels to be as Julius in New York and have that kind of strange analogy to it. And the out-of-the-wayness of Brussels appealed because if you think of Sebald writing in East Anglia, which is, in a way, the middle of nowhere, and how much he was able to get out of it. Or if you think of my brilliant acquaintance, Rana Dasgupta, whom you interviewed recently, who decided to set this book in Bulgaria precisely because it is sort of not anywhere really, but not anywhere really actually has its own very profound story, and it becomes somewhere because of the quality of attention that you pay to it. So that's what made Brussels.
Everything comes clear now. I had no idea you had heard Rana in our conversation.
Yes. He's kind of a double for me also.
Wow.
Because I'm writing a book about Lagos, Nigeria now. He's writing a book about Delhi. And we're both sort of coming off these debut novels that are about seekers in the unsteady 20th/21st century. Yeah.
You bring up Sebald. Answer two more questions about who you owe and then where you're going. People speak about Sebald. I feel Proust in a lot of this thing. People also mention James Joyce, and people like to see Joseph O'Neill of Netherland in your repertory. Do you want to make any additions or corrections?
Yes, sure. Open City wears its influences on its sleeve, and they are myriad. V.S. Naipaul likes to say that he has no influences. He says this.
But he's one of yours, surely.
But he's one of my influences. Nabokov, James Joyce, the early James Joyce. Ulysses is too peculiar to be an influence on this book. But Dubliners and Portrait of an Artist, these are both strong influences. Virginia Woolf, particularly in her journals, is a big influence. Zabelt, very much so. Joseph O'Neill, not at all, because I refused to read his book until mine was published. And I thought it was a wonderfully written book of post 9/11 New York, but not an influence. But the way influence has also worked is that, and Camus, of course, of The Plague and The Stranger and the journals again. This book has a feeling of a bit of a diary, and that's because I love to read the diaries of writers. Mm. Influence sometimes also works through people we have not read, because we read people who have read them. So Walter Benjamin, of whom I'm only beginning to read more, is very important to me because of all the people I have read who he has influenced. And the same thing is true of maybe someone like Proust, whom I haven't read a great deal of, but perhaps through reading many people who, unbeknownst to me, have read him. Lydia Davis,
yes,
is important to me, and I know Proust is important to her. So influence also works in that way. So I guess my aim is to have so many influences that I create my own thing. But ultimately, what it does is that then it frees me up to have fun with it. So there's a little passage in the book that is actually more or less lifted from The Dead by James Joyce.
Which piece?
At the end of his time in Brussels, when it starts to rain heavily. It's a little jazz riff on the end of The Dead from James Joyce's Dubliners.
Snow falling.
Snow falling. And the rain is general all over the land. And it's a little wink in the direction of the people who also love that. Because, you know what? I'm not worried about somebody saying, he is influenced by this. I want it to be more that those people who take pleasure in books can also take pleasure in what I have done, because it is a continuous conversation, you know, and that brings us full circle back to music, because this is something that happens all the time in music. If you listen to Keith Jarrett playing Poinciana, what you hear in it is Ahmad Jamal playing Poinciana.
Yeah.
He's not copying, he is paying due respect.
When you hear Charlie Parker come in on Funky Blues with Johnny Hodges, you feel the love.
That's right.
It's dripping off the recording.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, it's, in fact, jazz is a great example for the kind of approach I take to literary influence here, because excessive originality is fatal in a jazz man.
Hmm. So tell us where you're going, and we'll give you every blessing.
All right. Well, officially, I'm doing a book about Lagos now. I want to get more into cityness. And this city I grew up in, I want people to know more about it in its exorbitant and exultant and exaggerated complexity, which has yet to be properly written on the world stage.
What is the moment in this book where Fela Kuti in Los Angeles pops up and we say, aha?
That's right, that's right. That's when Farouk and Julius are discussing, and Julius thinks about young people who go to America and find their true radical selves there, because they are confronted with the ways in which America does not live up to its promise of fairness and justice, and it radicalizes them, and then they go back home and they are, for better or for worse, radicalized. For better in the case of Fela, for worse in the case of someone like Sayyid Qutb, who does become an Islamist radical, and goes on to inspire the Muslim Brotherhood. But the other thing I'm working on, and this is sort of simmering very softly below the surface, is in the years to come, I would like to write another novel. And I don't know what it'll be. I don't know where it'll go. But this morning, I was just thinking to myself, I am going to have to fully confront Ulysses. We can't keep pretending it didn't happen. We can't keep writing 19th century novels. You know, we can't pretend that that amazing, unexploded ordnance of a book did not happen. And in the far distance, people applaud that idea. So I take it as a sign from the gods.
And so do we. Teju Cole, it's a thrill to meet you and to hear all these ideas just kind of unfurl, and to feel, first, that I've known you for 1,000 years, and second, I can't wait to read the next. But to hear from you again and to talk again, this has been a great, great privilege.
For me, it has been an even greater privilege. Thank you very, very, very much, Christopher.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.